Well, it's been about 2 months now since we made the Greynado podcast a part of Hodinkee, and it seemed about time that we do a little crossover episode. The hosts of that show, James Stacey and Jason Heaton, are longtime members of the Hodinkee family, and this seemed like the perfect opportunity to sit down and talk about how they got into watches in the first place, why they decided to launch a podcast of their own, and some of their favorite memories from their time writing and talking about watches. You'll be hard-pressed to find two nicer, more humble dudes, and I'm extremely proud to call James and Jason not just colleagues, but also friends. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is brought to you by Tag Heuer. Stay tuned later in the episode to learn more about a new Heuer Octavia. You can also visit tagheuer.com to learn more. Cool. Thank you guys for joining us here. To have James and Jason in the same place is pretty special in Hodinkee land.
Yeah, the boys are together.
Our pleasure, yeah.
Yeah, we got TGN Hodinkee Radio crossover going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before we get into too much TGN stuff, I think it's worth saying that we have kind of, I guess, the oldest and newest longtime Hodinkee contributors with us here.
Yeah, true enough.
Right?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Because Jason, your time with Hodinkee actually extends before my time at Hodinkee.
Yeah, I was trying to remember when I wrote my first story for Hodinkee, and I think it was early 2010, I think. And it was, if I remember right, the first story I wrote for Hodinkee was about how you can sign up and bid on an online auction, it was Antiquorum or something back then. Totally not in my wheelhouse, but yeah. I remember, I think Ben asked me to write something about it, and so I researched it and wrote it. So I think it was 2010, so...
Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah, yeah.
That's real OG.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
So how did you get connected with Ben? Like, what was your kind of entree into Hodinkee? How did you discover the site, and then how did you get connected with Ben?
I got connected with Ben through the guys over at Gear Patrol, because I was writing with Gear Patrol back in, I think, 08 or 09.
Okay.
And at some point, I think either Eric Yang or Ben Bowers from Gear Patrol, they both knew Ben Clymer. You know, this was that era when all these great sort of, you know, blogs and sites were coming up, Continuous Lean and Hodinkee and Gear Patrol.
Oh, yeah.
And one of them said, Hodinkee's looking for some freelance help. And, you know, if you're interested. So I was put in touch with Ben and then kind of took it from there. So.
And it's scaled up pretty quickly, I think, from there, and then kind of maintained. I mean, you've always been a presence on the site as long as I've been involved.
Yeah, there was a bit of a gap, I think. And I think I don't remember where you were during that gap, but it was around the time that you guys were at you moved into that little WeWork space. I remember visiting. And then I remember I helped out with a pop-up at Northern Grade, which was a pop-up event in Minneapolis.
Which
was fun, but I've seen a lot of people come and go, and you've been a long-time presence, obviously, and but it's, to look at the site now, I was just looking back through old stories that I'd written, trying to figure out when I started, and it's just gotten so big, and here we are at H10, which is an incredible event, you know? I mean,
so people know, we're recording this the day before H10 starts. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
We've kind of got the gathering of all the Hodinkee, contributors, past, present, and current.
So yeah, yeah.
You were obviously interested in watches, and you were doing writing before Hodinkee.
Yeah.
How did both of those things kind of become a part of your life?
Well, as I mentioned, when I was writing for Gear Patrol, the site was largely, and still is to this day, focused on sort of product reviews and sort of product-based journalism. So
yeah.
I was doing a lot of outdoor gear. I was doing, you know, kayaks and skis and backpacks and jackets and things like that. And at that time, I was kind of more into the outdoor watch space. So, you know, your Suntos and Garmins and watches like that.
Sure.
But as I was kind of easing into sort of luxury watches, mechanical watches, and dive watches, It seemed like a logical fit for me because I've always viewed, and I still do sort of view, watches as kind of a piece of gear, a piece of equipment, sort of an extension of your, you know, your boot or your jacket. And then from there, I started, it was around the time, it was a little few years after I had started scuba diving as well. And, you know, a dive watch is kind of an extension of your diving gear. One thing led to another, and I started doing a couple of dive watch reviews for Gear Patrol, and then that transferred over with Hodinkee as well. So I come at watches from, I think, a different perspective than a lot of people who see them as sort of collectible, you know, mechanical art, things like that. And I totally appreciate that, and I get that. But I would say my background, kind of my focus or my expertise, if you want to call it that, is more from a watch as a something that's used, you know, whether it's the history of its use or how you can use it nowadays. So
yeah,
that's kind of where I come from and came from.
I have to say, I think one of the stories that stands out to me is, I think, still one of the great Hodinkee stories, and one that really kind of, if you can say it's groundbreaking. I think it was maybe something that other people weren't doing at the time, was your review of the AP Offshore Diver.
Oh yeah,
agree. Yeah.
Which is amazing. And I went back and looked at it recently because I was looking at some of your old stories ahead of recording this.
Yeah.
And that story still stands up, and it still feels so current and feels like the sort of thing that is really quintessential to what we do.
Yeah.
And then I looked at the date on it, and I think it was like 2011, early 2011.
Yeah.
And thinking back to what else was going on in the space back then, like, that must have been shocking. And I remember reading it back then, but it's with a little bit of perspective, it still feels so good and so current.
Well, that's good to hear that it still does, because I cringe sometimes when I look at old stories. And, but I remember that one. So I did, I don't know if it was subsequent years, but it was pretty close to each other. AP came out with the first, that Royal Oak Offshore Diver, just the steel version. And then the next one they came along with was the carbon or the ceramic? I don't remember which one would have come second.
I want to say it was the carbon.
I think it was the carbon.
It was an easier material.
And I remember going to SIHH and our friend Paul, who works with AP on the PR side, said, "Oh, we really liked what you did with that one. Would you like you to take the carbon one diving as well?" And that's the one I think I took to the Great Blue Hole in Belize. Mm. My wife Gashani does all the underwater photography, and we shot some video, I think, for one of these stories, and it was so bad. I mean, I cringe when I look at the kind of video quality that Hodinkee's doing nowadays. But what was really cool about that story was that I think AP liked it so much. And do you remember at the time they were sponsoring the 34th Street helipad here? The one that takes people from Long Island into the Manhattan?
Yeah.
And they had this giant video screen, and I never saw it, but I remember Ben told me that they liked that video so much that they actually, I don't know if they licensed it or they asked for permission to use it.
We probably just gave it to them.
Yeah,
back
I'm sure
then,
it just, yeah. And they were looping the video at the helipad in New York. So that was kind of
very cool.
A moment of pride, you know.
That's
so that was really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, before we move on, Gashani is kind of the unsung hero your work. I mean, people may not know this. It's always credited on the stories at the bottom, but it's super cool that that Gashani is doing all of this amazing underwater photography. People probably wonder how you are in so many of these shots.
Yeah, right, right.
But yeah, she's kind of the unsung hero of Hodinkee dive watch coverage.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, if not for her, you'd see a lot of disembodied wrist shots underwater. You know, we have fun. It's been a great way for us to travel and just do some really fun, cool stuff together. So yeah, she likes to be behind the scenes and you know, it's great. It's worked out really well.
And the work is incredible.
Yeah, she's like, gotten really,
there's
really,
nobody,
really,
there's nobody really playing good at that level.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's producing, like, nobody's even really, like, I tried to do a couple, like, with, even in some cases, with your help.
Yeah, yeah.
Of, like, an underwater dive watch review in Vancouver, there's no light, and everything looks like
that was pretty bad.
Yeah, it was just kind of a sketchy dive, big wall dive, and I remember, like, seeing results and being like, all right, this is good enough, it's a Seiko product, like, it's for the 777 review that I did with, it was a blog to watch at the time, and, like, I was happy with it, but then, like, if you one-to-one, even... Like, why did I even bother?
Yeah, right, right.
either play at a certain level or don't, and, like, I would say, like, yeah, if you want to match what you guys are doing as a team, you're going to have to come pretty hard. So.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, hats off. She's,
she does a great job.
Yeah, she does a great job. So.
Agreed.
Yeah.
So Jason's been with us for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
James, I've been trying to get you to work with us
for a long time. Yeah.
But I guess it was a little over a year ago now.
It would have been last August, roughly.
August?
Yeah,
okay.
It was when I quit the day job and kind of moved into this wholeheartedly, so.
Yeah. So can you tell people a little bit about that? I mean, we've obviously talked about it off mic, but, you know, what was your kind of background in watches, and then how did you end up making this a career?
Yeah, sure. I mean, got into watches, you know, a little over a decade ago. I was in university and finished university. Didn't really love the whole process of being a student at that level, but I learned that I did enjoy writing. Cool. And kind of the process of like taking an idea and developing it into something where the idea was what you're still offering at the end, essays, that sort of thing. And along that time, you know, the other thing I found that I liked is I enjoy research. I like learning about things, and not less so like sociological studies, and more so like cars and camera gear. And you know, I'll absorb, you know, various amounts of information as quickly as possible when I get interested in something new. And so that's very helpful in this line of work. And,
yeah, it's pretty necessary.
Yeah. And so at the time I had a Columbia field watch, a quartz thing, and it died. And like, I would have been, yeah, it would have been 11 or 12 years ago. And at the time I didn't even really realize, like, I guess I knew at some level it needed a battery. But that was like somewhere around the maximum of my like knowledge about watches.
Amateur hour over here.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. And I was like, I think that was somewhere around like, that was probably in the vein. Like I knew it needed a battery. I knew it operated on a battery. And in the pros, I went in to get another battery. And, I think as they do, and this is why they put the little battery shops at, you know, your department store among all the watches, is like you're waiting for somebody to put a battery in the watch you already own, but you're surrounded by all these watches you could own.
Yeah.
And so I walked around, I'm looking, and I'm like, you know, I kind of like the looks of these ones that are a little bit more rugged. And so then I literally just started like Googling. And at the time there's one or two watch blogs were in existence. You know, Watch Report was around, and I dug in and learned as much as I could. And I started buying and selling and flipping watches. And that just your normal progress from, you know, Invicta to Citizen and Seiko and you know, stuff that has some actual credibility and some stuff that's actually designed and referenced of a design that came from a time when watches were required, not merely trinkets. And, you know, the short of it is 2008, May 2008, I wrote my first piece for Watch Report. I was with them until they sold, didn't care for the new owner, who didn't know anything about watches, so there wasn't really much purpose anyways. It was like an SEO buy. And then by the time they sold, it wasn't even a good SEO purchase, because suddenly there was a Blocked Watch and there was Hodinkee, and there was like people that were operating at like, this wasn't like a cottage industry thing. This was an industry. There was people with like goals to be around for say 10 years, right?
Imagine or longer. That.
Yeah. And so I wrote for a Blocked Watch for a long time. And that's of course where I got to know Jason, that's where I got to know you, Stephen, and you know, we'd meet up at various events because I'd be covering for one site, you guys would be there for another, and Jason could be there for, you know, a few different entities at the time, and you and I kind of became friends. I think that we saw a lot of things the same way,
totally,
and had like an appreciation for when the work was done efficiently and at a good level, and that sort of thing. And then, yeah, over the years, it became clear that, you know, I wanted to make essentially a bid for writing full time, and that's a mix for me with watches and cars, which I, you know, my two loves. And yeah, so in August of last year, you know, a few things kind of fell into place, and I left what was a day job essentially in, let's be gentle and call it technical writing, but it was more like telling people how to put the batteries in their remote controls.
Okay.
That sort of thing. So I was pretty dry on that, and I mean, a lot of what I did at the time was replying to the occasional email and then writing posts in another window anyways.
Okay.
So I was mostly, you know, one foot out the door from that that sort of career, and made the transition. And I mean, the experiences I've had with Hodinkee are on such a different level.
Well, what was it like going from doing this part time to doing it full time? Because I kind of was very lucky in that I was doing this part time as a student, and then, you know, moved into doing this full time sort of right out of school.
Yeah.
What was it like transitioning from this being a hobby to this being really your career?
I mean, not that different, because like mentally I was very checked out of what would have been my actual career at the time. I was, you know, devoting a lot of time and energy for Grenado. I was devoting a lot of time and energy into things that I found rewarding, which was, going on these adventurous trips. I had arguably my final post with a blog to watch was this grand experiment, this scientific expedition to Clipperton and with Oris. And I think that was, you know, I had a few of those experiences where I did something that was like kind of where suddenly I felt like, okay, this is what I was meant to do. Whether it's been on a boat in the middle of the ocean or driving a car somewhere in Europe. Like, I think a lot of people could say this is what you're meant to do, but when you're actually there and it feels like home, I think a lot of people can do it and it's fun, but it's different, I think, if that feels like the sweet spot for you. I don't know how common that part is, but it felt very like sweet spot for me. And I think that's where I found that transition to making it a day job, like supernatural. I joked, you know, with the people I used to work with that about 2 days after I left, I forgot the last like 6 years of my professional life. It all feels like I was there for a week.
Nice.
It was all, you know, the work wasn't that interesting. And I don't deal well, and you can attest to this at a high level, I don't deal well with bureaucracy at all. Like, things can be easy or they can be hard. And if they're hard, I'll probably just not do them.
Okay.
It's
good to know.
But like,
take note.
Yeah. But like, you know, like, I like when there's a process. And I don't mind if the process is complicated, but working for a big company sucks. Working for a Hodinkee or a small magazine in Vancouver is awesome, because if you want to talk to someone, I can just talk directly to you. I don't have to wait for a big meeting with 40 people where nobody gets to say anything important. And like, I just don't deal with, I don't like big company structures. I don't think I was ever designed to be like a decent employee for a large company where like you could just coast. And of course, this living, there's no coasting.
Yeah.
There's no coasting. We're all sharks. You got to keep water moving over the gills, or you need to die and move on. Find another phase.
Hopefully mostly the former, little of the latter.
Well, I mean, die, like you need to sunset the idea that you're going to be some sort of a producing writer if you're not willing to do the work. So
while all of this is going on for both of you, you guys team up and do the Greynado.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Obviously, I know you guys have known each other through the industry, but how did it go from being like, oh, we're like, you know, we see each other at trade shows and at events
answer that like as quickly as possible. Like,
I was going to give a shout out to our friend Mike Pearson.
Yeah, I think we can go a step further or a step further back. Definitely Mike is who connected us face to face.
Yeah. Mike Pearson, if you don't know, is the he's the former U.S. brand manager for Braemont.
Yeah.
And
a sweetest dude and insanely capable, like he was amazing at his job. And like, I'm sure people listening will know exactly what I mean when I say like the fact that Braemont's successful in the U.S. is Mike.
Yeah.
The guy's just very talented. He's also a really nice guy. And he, Jason and I had traded, you know, the occasional message, you know, you had Paul Hubbard. Yeah. Had bought your Pelagos, mm-hmm. And I'm Paul Hubbard's previous writer for Blocked Watch, who I'm still very much friends with, and so we're always kind of in touch. And then it just kind of became like maybe we were on wider circle, and then suddenly we weren't, and then so eventually you just end up in the same room.
Yeah,
and that was because of Mike, and that was at Basel, 2013, maybe. Five years ago.
Yeah, so a nice little long while ago.
Yeah, of course, 2014. We've only just finished episode. We're coming up on episode 70. We took a short hiatus. So it's been just a little over 2 years that we've been doing it.
The show
pretty steadily.
And so, how did you go from being friends and sort of professional colleagues at a distance to making this show? Like, what was the idea when you said we'll do a podcast?
We're kind of like chatting more and more, and I adore, like, I've been into podcasts. And people say this, but I'll challenge you. Like, tell me about the first podcast. I was in like some of the first podcasts that were ever on iTunes. If you remember the very early days of like This Week in Tech, when like Kevin Rose, who of course is now oddly in the same circle, but very, very early podcasting.
And who we'll be seeing this weekend at HT.
Yeah, I've never met him, so that'll be fun. But the like, I can go back into university, you know, 12, 13 years ago, where I had an iPod because it had podcasting. And I like that form of media. I grew up in a household that listened to the Canadian Broadcasting Company and you know, or corporation, and you had talk radio on a lot, mm-hmm. and I kind of like it a lot. I find it a little bit more engaging than music, or at least engaging in a more passive way. And I love that I can learn about things from an expert in a manner where I'm not reading a textbook or necessarily even reading their whole book. Like we had Jason Fried on Hodinkee Radio, and like I would love to read his book, and I will get to it at some point, but I like that I can just listen to an hour of him talking, which is a conversation I'll probably never get to have, just to sit down and chat with him for an hour. These kind of top thinkers. And that's what podcasting's always brought, is this kind of like top thinker to the space. And I don't think that necessarily Jason and I are top thinkers in any given space, but if you want to talk about the four or five things that we outline as being like a Greynado aesthetic, the vibe, the family, I think that we're so deep into those things that we at least provide a conversation that we would listen to if it was two other people from the same space. That's the rough pitch, I suppose. But yeah, you know,
I'm kind of old school kind of talk radio fan as well, but I hardly ever listen to podcasts besides this one, of course, and our own. But James, he had the real brainchild for the Greynado. He even had the title, the Greynado.
It's a good name.
Yeah,
that's how pretty much where all my watches. So
and he does the editing and so he had already had this idea of how we could do it. So we basically record at a distance, James in Vancouver and then myself in Minneapolis. And we were just doing it over a Skype conversation, hopefully with a good connection, which has been, you know, knock on wood, good.
Pretty reliable so far.
Pretty reliable. And then some good quality microphones at home, and then we just capture each recording, and then James edits it together. And, you know, the topics have all really flowed. I mean, it's been such a nice, natural
whatever we're into
conversation.
Yeah.
That at first, I remember when we started this, I was thinking, you know, how are we going to come up with topics and keep things interesting and talk about things for, you know, and every show we're like, oh, this one'll be a pretty short one. And then over an hour.
That's how it always goes.
Yeah.
Every single time I think like, we're going to do a 40-minute show finally. Yeah. It's an hour five
and
every time.
And we've done full episodes, quite a few full episodes that have nothing to do with watches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, you know, some people like, some people don't. And I think when we first kind of came into the Hodinkee fold, I remember seeing a few comments like, someone made some comment about, I can't wait for James's next in-depth review of a DOP kit or something. Because we do stuff like that. You know, we talk about backpacks and we talk about trips and movies.
That's good though, right?
It is. Yeah. I mean, that's our vibe. That's who we are.
So. I mean, it's James, travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, sometimes watches.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that how you would describe it? Is that the...
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you said a minute ago, it's like these four or five core ideas.
Absolutely, yeah. And then I mean, those tangentially flow into other things. Like we first did a movie club episode for episode 69, and that wasn't necessarily our favorite movies.
Right.
But it was what we think are movies that fall into the milieu of those five or six topics.
It's a great episode, by the way. We'll link to it in the show notes here.
We had fun with it. And interesting feedback. People seem to enjoy it. And we got some like in-depth emails about some errors that I made about films. So that's always fun, too.
It's always good.
Yeah.
I actually love it when people point out that you've made mistakes, and it's like politely
positioned.
The like ones when people are like, oh, hey, you know, by the way, like, here's something you didn't know about a thing you were talking about. It's good, you know?
Absolutely. It's good to keep learning. You know, I said the folk singer in Life Aquatic was French. He's Belgian. He's not singing French. He's singing in Spanish, maybe.
I think he's singing in Portuguese.
Portuguese. There it is. Okay. So, yeah, I got that. I got that dead wrong, and I appreciate the fact check. Absolutely. Especially like the fact that like, my ego aside, that I got something wrong. The fact that somebody would like hear something that one of us said and like it enough or care about us enough to be like, I'm going to open my laptop, pen a 300-word email, like very nicely, not like no anger, no, and just like, and then also added like a bunch of other color about other movies that they like, and we got a bunch of recommendations for what should be in the next five episodes of the film club. Should we, opt to continue that as a little sub-series.
The most rewarding
the
part...
The nicest fans.
That's been the most rewarding part of doing the Greynado has been the feedback from listeners. And not just... there's something about a podcast, and maybe it's the same with radio as well, but hearing somebody's voice, it brings the connection closer whether you've met the person or not. And I think then when we get feedback from people, it's very...
It's never like a YouTube comment or
it's
like
very
it's
kind.
Never snide. Yeah,
yeah,
people are
snide.
Super nice.
And the people we've met, I mean, I meet people all the time. And I remember for a while we were trying to establish how many listeners we actually have. How big is our audience? And judging by the people I bump into and just meet that say, I thought I recognized your voice from across the room. You're the guy that does the Greynado, and I've always wanted to meet you. And I hate when people say it's humbling, but it is humbling
to
kind of just suddenly that level of feedback and kindness that comes from people. And people will, you know, reach out and say, if you're ever coming through my city, I'd love to, you know, buy you a beer.
Oh, yeah. I have a Google Keep list of like cities where people have said, like, if you're here and you've got nothing to do for an evening, so, like reach out.
Yeah. 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 It's great.
I agree with you. There's something, I mean, I've been an avid podcast listener also for probably about a decade.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I did not grow up in a family that listened to a lot of talk radio, but my wife did, and you know, I was into podcasts, and kind of she got me into the more NPR style talk radio.
It's a little closer to the microphone.
It's a little bit softer. Yeah. We're here with Hodinkee Radio. Mm-hmm.
You need a really good last name.
You do, and a very
there's
different
no,
voice.
There's no
than
James Stacy
the
on
one
NPR.
Yeah. I have more of the, I guess, fast-paced neurotic voice than the soft, close to the mic voice. But there is something really intimate about it. And I find that, you know, working in media, I know so many other people in media that I often find I'm reading a magazine story and I see the byline and go, oh, that's a friend or an acquaintance or somebody I've met, you know, once at a cocktail party, whatever. There's something about the, when you hear somebody's voice, I often get the feeling that I know them, even if it's somebody I've never met before and never had any interaction with. And weirdly, sometimes those relationships can end up feeling more intimate than the ones that are actual two-way relationships. So just, it's funny to even call them relationships because it's not like the other person doesn't know I exist, but it feels that way.
I think a lot of it comes down to the, there is like, there's a very strong emotional bond you form by listening, especially if you're a good listener, but even just listening to someone. And especially like, even if you're not like a quality listener in your life, if you listen to 90 hours of Jason and I talking, which is kind of an absurd pursuit, but okay.
I don't know if I've listened to 90 hours of you guys talking.
But like that, you know, that's what we've put out into the world, right? And people spend a lot of time reading your article, but I think that that's digested in a way that's not like listening, it's processing. Whereas I think a lot about podcasting is, you know, you're allowing or you're creating something where somebody gets in on a conversation that they otherwise wouldn't. Because Heaton and I would be having these conversations over text or Slack or whatever, either, regardless. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of the entire impetus behind this show, right? Like when we sat down and decided we wanted to do a podcast, we knew we didn't want to do a straight interview show. We knew we didn't want to do a thing where we sit down with a tray of watches in front of us and attempt to describe the look of a bunch of products on radio.
Yeah.
Be super boring. Mm-hmm. I promise to everyone listening to this, like, you're welcome. otherwise we would have no listeners to this show. But the idea really came about from this thought that we're very lucky that we get to have conversations with super interesting people. Mm-hmm. I mean, in you know, my career, I can easily say the best part of this job has not been the cool places I've gotten to travel, the interesting products I've gotten to see. It's the amazing people I get to have conversations with. And I am regularly meeting people who just blow me away and getting to give people a kind of window into those conversations. And that's why this show is a conversation and not an interview.
Yeah.
We just thought it would be much, much more fruitful and much more interesting. Yeah. And, you know, it might go places that are not, you know, the kind of standard 10 or 15 questions that everybody in this business gets asked constantly. And it's had mixed results, I think, for some listeners. I think some listeners have found certain conversations to not be watch-centric enough.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to bounce on. Like, I don't want to speak for Jason, but like a lot of it is like when you just write about one thing, like people are multiple things.
Right.
You know, you're into, and Jason's into stuff like Jason's into elements of things that like I don't even land that well for me. And I'm into things that don't land that well for Jason, right?
Totally.
But wherever that overlap is for us, and there's some things where like we learn things from each other and that kind of thing, like as far as nerdiness goes. But I think that like I never understand when I see a comment, and I know that the person who made that comment is probably the people who make these comments are listening. So like just consider your mindset when you make this comment.
Right.
We're like, oh, that episode didn't have enough about watches, or you guys should really get back to watches. Like, I don't need to know about this. Oh, okay. I mean, I think like you have to understand that the people who bring you Hodinkee or people who bring you TGN or people who bring you 99% Invisible, like they love things. And the fact that you got on board should suggest that if they love something that you don't understand yet, there's probably something there. There's probably some meat on those bones. There's probably like it's not just like Jason and I are randomly firing in the dark to hit a topic. Like there's some thought that goes into it, and it's and it's a natural decision. So it's like we don't have to talk about movies because Criterion's paying us or something like that. It's just not the way that things work.
You're
like,
not on the Criterion dole.
No, I mean, Criterion's.
You
got to
get that sweet sweet Criterion money.
Right? I mean, like that's you don't go through all the movies. We didn't link them all out to Amazon. Like it's not like we don't make a movie episode, which is largely not about watches.
Right.
It's just because we like movies and you watch movies a lot.
For sure. I mean, I think almost every episode of Hodinkee Radio so far has received at least one comment or email of somebody saying it's their favorite episode yet, which leads me to believe like we're doing okay.
Perfect.
Like not every episode has to be everyone's favorite episode, but as long as it's someone's favorite episode, we're doing all right.
Yeah. And I think that there is some value in creating something that has some negative feedback.
I agree.
It doesn't bother, like if 1% of your of the vocal audience, which is again 1/10 of the actual percentage of the people who are reading it, are going to be commenting, and especially them being taking the time to share a negative thought. And I'm not saying criticism is fine. Criticism's preferable because it helps you make the product better. But just Absolutely. General negativity, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because at least it means you made a stance somewhere in the.
Completely.
You know, like you don't think about the $5 sandwich you had 3 weeks ago. You think about the really good meal you had 2 years ago.
Or the
really bad meal.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So
it made an impact.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
And now a message from this week's sponsor.
Hello, I'm Hodinkee Editor-in-Chief Jack Forster. In the early 1970s, automatic chronographs represented the newest in watchmaking technology. But at the outset, they struggled to find an audience. So in 1972, Jack Heuer came up with a marketing campaign in partnership with Viceroy Cigarettes and the Parnelli Jones Racing Team and its drivers, Mario Andretti, Al Unser, and Joe Leonard. He brought a hot new Octavia, the reference 1163, to unprecedented global success. Overnight, the 1163 became the hottest-selling wristwatch chronograph in America and secured Heuer's position as the creator of motorsports chronographs, a story you can see covered in depth on Hodinkee.com. This year, an all-new Octavia brings the runaway hit style of the classic 1163 right into the present day, with the unmatched style and incredible wrist presence that made the original such a classic. You can find out all about it at TagHeuer.com. And now, back to the show.
So, kind of moving beyond the Grey Nato and the podcast space. I mean, we're all watch guys, obviously. So I thought it could be fun to talk about some of either your favorite stories that you've produced for the Grey Nato, for Hodinkee, for elsewhere, and some of the stories that you kind of would be dying to do that we can maybe, hopefully we can make them happen. And if not, we can figure out how to make them happen down the road. But do either of you have a standout? We'll start with the Grey Nato. Do you have like a standout Grey Nato moment that you're just super proud of?
No.
I can see you guys are looking at each other as if one of you will tip the other one off.
Like, I feel like the show doesn't, like in many ways, maybe this is a discredit to us, that the show doesn't swing for the fences in terms of like big content. It's about a conversation about 50, maybe 50 things in the span of an hour. You know, we've done some fun interviews.
Yeah,
which have been nice, and I'd like to grow the interview side of it, like talking with people who fall into the general milieu of the show. But I don't think that there's like, you know, I think our Basel coverage has always been pretty interesting, because I think that when you talk about Basel or SIHH, like Jason and I stand out at SIHH.
Yeah,
you know, we're not dressed up. Have you ever owned a Hotorology watch, like a watch that would fall in like IWC? Sure, but like, neither of us have ever had like a Langa. Neither of us have ever had like QP or something like that. Like, you've got on an old Doxa, which is much more rare than a lot of Langas or general QPs out there. I'm wearing the Explorer I wear all the time. And I like, so there's situations where I think we bring a perspective that's maybe not common to the general tone of the overall scene.
Okay.
I think we've had some episodes that have fallen flat.
Okay.
But yeah, I can't think of, I wouldn't say fallen flat completely, but you know, some that maybe, when we finished, I was like, eh, I'm not sure that's going to resonate with a lot of people. But I would say,
I think we're generally critical.
One of the highlights,
that's why you both do good work, is because you're both super critical of your work.
I don't know if I would call them the best episodes, but the most fun episodes that we've done have been the ones where we've been in person.
Yeah, for sure.
And we're going to record again here in New York while we're here. It's just nice to do it face to face. I don't know. Yeah, there's something a little bit different about it. You know, we've made it work really well doing it from a distance, but, we did our one-time TGN Summit.
I owed you a second Summit for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I flew out there, and we did hiking, we did diving.
We had some Fruit Loops, we had some whiskey.
Food. We met with Jason Lim from Helios.
We did. We had some amazing food with Jason, for sure.
Yeah.
In Vancouver,
I got to see Vancouver and we recorded, and we talked about it, and it was kind of, was it our first time doing it in person? Maybe we'd done it at some press,
I think we'd probably done like an SIHH in the hotel room something like that.
But the in-person stuff is fun.
I agree.
And I think what was neat about that was incorporating some of our loves, like you know, James took me up to the top of this mountain that was purportedly the spectacular view, amazing, and it was completely overcast. So we were up
Saint
above
Mark's
the clouds.
Summit, you can
and
see about just, 30 feet.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're supposed to be able, you know, you can basically see the entirety of Howe Sound on a clear day. Yeah. It's an incredible view, but it was not great. And then the dive was okay.
Dive was okay, but
it was a big wall dive.
I always say a bad day of diving is better than a good day doing anything else. But I had a couple of gear snafus that day and whatever, but it all lends to that.
Is that when
that
the reg was bleeding?
Yeah, my rig came loose.
Yes, yeah, to drive back into fixed town. It. That's right. Yeah. And we had no gas at one point. I had the gas in the car forever. Yeah.
People are now seeing how the sausage is made, right?
Exactly.
Like they see this like really beautifully produced podcast with like
it's always an
amazing underwater photograph.
Right.
But really, it's about like driving back and forth and getting gear fixed.
Exactly.
And like finding a decent bowl of fruit.
Yeah, eating Rainier cherries or candied salmon, like stuff for Vancouver.
Exactly. So that was good.
And in terms of like broader stories, like from you guys have both been doing this a decent amount of time, what are some things you're really proud of? If we can get on the eve of H10, we'll get a little nostalgic.
You mentioned people. And for me, the stories that I've been able to do where I've met or talked to interesting people, people that have done amazing things. I think back to when I was in Mexico a couple of years ago and I got to go diving with Sylvia Earle. You know,
the legend.
Meeting her was it was even beyond, you know, things you read about her. She just had this incredible presence. That was really amazing. The story I did a follow up to recently on Charles Worley, the World War II POW who got the Patek Philippe. In the prison camp.
What a sweetheart.
You know, I think it's those stories that really stand out. Bob Barth, the C-Lab diver, Navy diver. I spoke with him on the phone.
That was pretty high on my favorite pick for the H-10 one.
Yeah. I mean, to me, those really stand out. I mean, certainly, you know, getting to dive with a lot of amazing pieces. The Richard Mille piece that I took to St. Bart's, the $150,000 watch. Taking that diving was a thrill, but it really, for me, it's the people. It's the as you mentioned. I mean, this industry has a lot of potential to be very shallow and sort of superficial in many ways. But when you go below that level of just the product, and all the people that are involved, I think that those have been the highlights for me.
So from a Hodinkee standpoint, I would say I've really enjoyed that. Obviously, you guys expect that I would bring my skill set and apply it as much as possible, but you've also given me a lot of latitude to try some stuff that was, or even you just asked for things where my gut would have been to be like, nope, not really my strong suit. So like, I got the invite this past year to go to Villa d'Este, Concorso della Ganza in Italy. And obviously the part of the request was to photograph cars, which is well within my wheelhouse. And it was to do an interview with Wilhelm Schmidt, which is a piece I'm exceedingly proud of. He was great.
It's a great story.
And we spoke about stuff that I feel like we spoke about topics that are important to me. And to hear from a perspective of somebody so vastly different than mine, I always appreciate. Sure. And I thought that came out really well. But like I remember like you guys also said like, oh, we'd like you to do like a watch spotting / fashion thing. And I was like, nah, dog.
I can see you rolling your eyes again
not,
as you tell
not
the
rolling
story.
My eyes because I like looking I like reading those posts but like at the, my stress level just immediately went through the roof.
Sorry for that.
Like you hear me on the microphone and Jason will know this is like because Jason's very much wired the same way like fine on a microphone for half an hour fine at a you know an event for a day but like H10 is going to wipe me out. I'm an introvert. And Monday, I'm going to be a monster.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good to know. You have to go back in the cave.
Exactly.
I'm flying to Switzerland on Monday, so that's good to know. I will be out before you're a monster.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll become like a bit of a recluse. And that's how you recharge, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I enjoy things like editing the podcast. That's a very like singular, that's inside your own head, that sort of thing. And I mean, the big thing that I've learned from Hodinkee is like, as much as the writing, I adore the photography, and it's been like a very long process to learn how to shoot watches. But now you guys very quickly just are like, well, the guy can shoot a watch. Like he must be able to also shoot a bunch of Italians who can't speak English and don't understand why he's walking up, staring at their wrist, and then crouching right into their midsection with a camera. And again, we're not speaking the same language. Everybody's dressed beautifully. It was like
it was hot there too, wasn't it?
I was just trying to pull the Fahrenheit. It was 30 Celsius in the sun.
All right.
So that's 94.
Hot.
It was like 92, 94 degrees, something like that. And I was sweating profusely. So I must have looked like a complete train wreck walking up to these beautiful, you know, Italian people and Europeans, and they're dressed beautifully and they've got some like $40,000 watch on their wrist, and you're like, oh, I'd like to get a photo, and they're
you're
like,
just like grunting at them basically.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, who is this dumb American? And yeah, like, he's
not knowing that you're
my
Canadian.
Watch and not and they knew I was a Canadian by the time we were done talking.
You're also way politer than any of us.
As polite as I could be. And but yeah, I've enjoyed is there's a comfort zone that I had established in you know, essentially sticking to a lane, especially, you know, with a blog to watch. And I got to step outside that lane a few times. Like the Clipperton piece is one that I'll be proud of for the rest of my life. It was 3,500 words and took 17 days on a boat to produce. I was the only working journalist on the boat.
17 days is a serious investment in a story.
Absolutely. And a huge investment from Oris, who put me on that boat and sure. And basically had the opportunity to have two seats on the boat. One went to a contest winner, one went to me. And yeah, I'm proud of that sort of work. But otherwise, I mostly stuck to a laneway of producing reviews. And with Hodinkee, you know, where I found like a lot of rewarding is there's an impetus and not a pressure, but like an encouragement to expand.
Yeah.
Find all the areas you can be good at rather. But we obviously we'd still want to do a review, still want to do hands-on, still want to shoot the photos, all that kind of thing. But there's a lot of space there. So when it came to like... when it came to the fashion slash watch thing, you know, it worked out. I'm very proud of that piece, but it was like a very stressful 2 days of shooting those photos. And then I got to do, you know, sometimes I'll pitch things where like, I don't actually know, like there's no general benefit to Hodinkee for like my micro brands piece, but mm-hmm. I got more feedback about that than any piece I've written
in a very long time. We're going to link all these up in the show notes too, so people can go back and look at these. Cause
yeah, so
I think these are stories that are worth looking back at and thinking about kind of in light of what you guys are saying.
So like my general, like probably where I would be more or less an expert in the space is with these watches that are under about $1,000 and typically are the creation of one person's like idea for design. So that's your Halioses, your Autodromos, your Ferrers, your Ravens, and that sort of thing, like things that fall into that vein. And there's now that market used to be $500 and $600, then it was $500 and $700, and then $500 and $1,000, and now you have Oaken Oscar and Fair again, you know, cracking well into Manta, cracking well into the $2,000 space. So there's a market there that's expanding rapidly, but it's only enthusiasts. So when you write something that's only enthusiasts, you have to be ready to be told that you missed something or you cornered it wrong. But I got feedback from all the brands, and it came together better than I expected. And so that kind of thing is nice because I had the latitude to just like, I didn't have to hit a deadline with it. I just had it.
Yeah. Well, I've got to say, you know, ahead of asking you those questions, I had thought about kind of and looked back at what both of you have done for the site. And was trying to come up with my sort of favorite things and why, and the things that I think make them Jason stories or James stories. And it's funny, Jason, that you said the personalities. I think a lot of people probably, when they think of you, immediately think of your dive coverage and the beautiful underwater photos, the kind of like taking something out in the world, really putting it through its paces. Like, it is a genuine dive review.
Yeah.
But I agree. I think the stories you do with people that involve some aspect of either an interview or spending time with people, you know, those people who don't do this for a living might not realize that those stories are really tough to do because, you know, people, if you're meeting them under the circumstances of writing a story about them, they probably have a sense of where they want the story to go.
Yeah.
And you as an author and a reporter have some idea of where you want this story to go. And if either of those perspectives comes out kind of straight, totally uncut, it's probably not going to be super interesting because you probably have some sort of misconception and they have some kind of ego thing going on or some kind of like self-perception thing going on.
Yeah.
But being able to spend time with somebody and really like empathize with them and tease something out of them that they don't know is there is, I think, really powerful. And I think you do that in a really, really excellent way. And I think those stories really feel like you, and anybody who gets the chance to sit down and have a conversation with you, and hopefully they can hear it a little bit here, I think will understand that. It's a way of listening and a way of speaking with someone I think really comes through in those stories.
And I think, you know, that Sylvia Earle story stands out for me because
I agree.
It was a mix of both. It was diving with Sylvia Earle. I mean, to actually take somebody, and rather than just sit down with it for a one-to-one interview, but actually go underwater with her in arguably her most comfortable environment.
Yeah, you don't get to go into space with an astronaut. You don't get in the race car with with a Formula One driver. Like, you have to see them adjacent.
Yeah, and ironically, you know, you can't talk underwater, so it's a lot of observation. And you know, for anyone who doesn't know about Sylvia Earle, just either check out the story or just Google her. I mean, she's the most remarkable, one of the most remarkable people alive today. And the fact that she's still diving at age 83 or whatever she is now was really remarkable. But I think those kind of stories are really fantastic.
I think no matter what you write about, what I like about your writing, and in many ways what I try and essentially copy or steal or whatever you want to call it, is like there's a humanity that you bring to it. I'm very focused on numbers and specs and like a personal impression, but a lot of your work is like it's open to whatever the environment was, and whether that's you know, Bonaire or Sri Lanka or the other people who were on a dive trip with you, like their character plays out in a piece that like might only be a couple thousand words or 1,500 words. Yeah. Like that, that's not a lot of meat like to work with there if you want to start including other impressions. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
right.
And I've always appreciated that at a high level.
I do think, you know, just to riff off of that, I mean, just doing the Grey NATO with James, I think we've helped each other improve. I mean, I think we've, not only in our writing, but I think just in as people. I mean, I think we've been able to, not to get too gushing here and you know,
sappy,
but you know,
for.
It's, I think I've learned a lot from him, with his attention to detail and his technical savvy and his, the way that he writes his reviews. I don't pay enough attention to the details. And it's something that in observing him work and reading his stuff has, impacted me in a way that I'm trying to get better at that myself. And what sounds like from what he's saying, it's worked the other way as well. So I think, you know, doing the podcast has had this unintended side effect, the really positive thing.
Well, it's definitely for me, it's definitely one of these things where I genuinely believe that you become the average of the five people you spend the most time with. It's a very important thing that I consider in my life, especially as somebody who I don't have that many friends. Like I don't have like people I hang out with that often in Vancouver, and I don't have an office I go into anymore, so we don't have like a built-in social kind of scenario. So to have Jason as a sounding board, as someone who's, you know, been in the this form of a career longer than I have, so I can get advice, I can you know, kind of glean or steal in some cases, you know, methodologies and thinking has been, you know, very valuable. And it's something I probably don't say enough, but I don't take it for granted.
I think it's funny that you said a minute ago that like you think of yourself as being really focused on specs and numbers, because when I was thinking about the stories I like best from you, I think it's the ones that are personality driven and take into account a sense of humor and a sort of like no bullshit attitude. I think, you know, we've all talked about this, and you know, this isn't going to be shocking to anybody listening, but there's so much like fluff and bullshit and marketing in this world. And I think you do a really good job of cutting through that in a sort of soft but incisive way.
I got to have some fun with that with the, you guys are letting me essentially run this never ending series of gold watches.
Yeah. So that's part of what came to mind. And this watch, was it the Mito that you shot with the Hawaiian shirt?
Yeah.
And it's like, you sent me a Slack message one day that was like, if this is super weird and you don't want to run this, tell me.
Just, I'll change it.
But
I'll
like,
shoot it.
I shot all these photos with a ridiculous Hawaiian shirt and I wrote about it. And like, I think it's okay, but I don't know. And it was awesome.
It was pink flamingos on the lawn, basically.
Yeah,
like, this is the.
It worked and it's super cool. And it, I think it's a good reminder not to take these things so seriously. And even a watch like your review of the Tudor Black Bay GMT, which I think is still to this day, I think one of the greatest Week on the Wrists we've ever published.
I mean,
proud to have been a small part of
that. Certainly, that certainly came to mind when you asked me earlier, like what, but I cannot take credit for that because that was the product of, you know, three people plus myself in two locations working kind of tirelessly to keep everything together and to produce it and Gray. And then of course there's a huge amount of editing that goes into that. And that's the same thing. Like if you want to talk about what I was personally proud of, I mean, the talking watches with Moki Martin. I've never received so much undeserved praise. He deserves the praise. And then of course, Will and Gray, who produced that episode and put the cameras up and actually made me not a bumbling fool in the very hot San Diego heat that, you know,
The people that the audience doesn't see are often the most important people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Without a doubt. There's no talking. Like, anybody can, like, I genuinely believe anybody on the staff could sit down and talk with a guy like Monkey Martin. He makes you feel at home. We're in his house. That was the easiest it's ever going to be. And that's kind of the same with David Robinson. I really cheated my way into the first two talking watches I had to do because these guys were both sweethearts. They both already knew what they wanted to talk about and they didn't care where it went or how long it took.
Yeah.
Just turn the cameras on and, like, they were both personalities. They're both really nice. And all I had to do was essentially not get in their way or my own way. Just be there. Like, you kind of could have done both of those to camera.
Yeah.
Without me.
And our video team makes it so easy too. I mean, you know,
it's incredible.
Gray, who produces this show, mm-hmm. and then Will and Dave on the video team. I mean, again, the listeners,
the heroes.
You don't see these guys, but these are the guys who make sure that the things that the three of us do here, that we don't look like idiots out in the world, and that these things are kind of digestible and enjoyable to watch, as opposed to just, like, you know, this show could easily end up being like 2 hours of me babbling at somebody. And
absolutely,
Gray keeps me in check.
And I think, you know, James's Mito review and the video, the really great videos that Hodinkee's doing now, it goes to show, I'm not just blowing the horn of Hodinkee, but I think the industry, our industry, writing about watches, producing content about watches, we needs to be this way nowadays. You know, we've matured enough. 10 years of quote unquote watch blogs mm-hmm. has got to get to the point where
you
knock things
driven.
Down a little bit of a couple of pegs, you know, when you're talking about a watch. There's only so many times you can talk about the ETA movement inside or, you know, the materials it's made out of.
Yeah.
You have to talk about and show how it resonates with the people. And I think
what's the purpose?
The great videos that bring out the personalities and then just the maturity of the way the content is presented. I mean, these expert videos are just, they're just amazing to me, you know?
Yeah.
So it's,
we're also really lucky that, you know, it's obviously changed a lot since the early days of Hodinkee. I mean, back to my early days about 6.5 years ago, I guess. And so, you know, the days when Jason, you were writing and you know, it was very much a blog, and it was a blog in the traditional sense of, like, everybody kind of did their own work.
Yeah.
Everybody shot and wrote their own stories. You didn't really show it to anybody. I mean, maybe, like, Ben would read my stuff and I would read his stuff just to make sure there were no typos, but it wasn't, there was no editing at all.
Yeah,
that wasn't happening. And, you know, video was for a long time, Will running everything, often running like 3 camera shoots by himself, like a madman, for a very long time, asking me to, like, try to hold a camera steady, which is a nightmare. He learned very quickly not to do that. But, it's gone from that to really being much more of a magazine process. And I think, you know, the result of that is that, you know, we have a meeting every week. We're sitting, pitching ideas, figuring out who's going to write what, who's going to help out with what. You know, James, you mentioned the GMT review. It was four of us working on that. You know, you in front of the camera, Gray.
Yeah, but I mean, we also got back, and then Will's directly involved in the overall scope of the project.
For
we
sure.
wanted to make it as big as possible. I overwrote it, and you guys fixed that. Like,
sure.
I took it too far.
Probably ended
in a few
up,
cases,
you're right, being 6 or 7 people involved in producing that story.
And I mean, like, you look at that video, and there's lots of people here listening who haven't been in the process of, like, learning of making a video. So there was a script and there was a plan. I mean, we didn't have a shot list, but that's probably where we're headed with these sorts of projects if you wanted to do something like that, because you have a limited amount of time and a huge amount of asset being tied up in the production of something like that. And yes, you need a great team and you need an idea and you need execution and you need planning and you need all of that. And luckily, like, after 10 years, Hodinkee's at the stage where they can do it. And, like, we've been doing some pretty serious navel gazing here, but let's be really fair. The team is incredible.
Yeah,
we got Joe, we got Jack, we got John.
I mean, you talk about you becoming the average of the people you spend the most time with.
Yeah, let me hang out with Joe Thompson forever.
Yeah.
I completely agree. We are all better for having everybody else on the team. And, you know, I often think I have the best job on the team. Like, I'm the luckiest, because what happens is, you know, one of you guys comes up with a really great idea, pitches it. I say, great, go make it. You go do all the hard work.
Yeah, yeah.
And then one day I get an email that says, hey, this is ready for you. And I get to go be the first person to read the awesome thing you've done.
You make
and
it
then,
look a bit better in the CMS. Or
whatever.
Like,
I mean,
we're learning.
A negligible amount of work. But I basically get the good fortune of saying, that's a great idea. Go do that. And then I get to be the first person who sees it and reads it. And then we figure out how we're going to get the most eyeballs on it.
Yeah.
And like, it's super fun. And the excitement and surprise, like people may not realize it, but like I get the same experience that you get as the reader or listener with most of the stuff we publish, if it's not written by me, in that I kind of know what's coming a little bit, but then it shows up. And like this Mito review, like it was like, oh, okay, we'll write a little hands-on story about a Mito. And what we got was something far more interesting than that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get that same sense of surprise and delight. And it's exciting in that somehow, you know, writing about, people always ask me when I tell them what I do for a living, like, there's enough to write about watches
endless.
For years and years.
Imagine
and years.
How much no you say.
Right, right.
Yeah. In
we
the
say
process.
No to a lot.
So much fat gets cut away.
But I still get to have that sense of excitement of like,
or you
new,
see you
fun
see a new
stuff.
Episode, you see a new episode of the podcast, which you know that we weren't on, and you were, but like or likely were. But I get excited when I see one where, especially if I don't know the person's name, because that means somebody drew them in. Or like when I open the when I don't know sneakers.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
At
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
So I opened right. I opened issue 3 of the magazine, a magazine that I was heavily involved with, but I didn't read the Ronnie story. And like, that's next level.
Yeah.
I get to dive into someone else's nerdiness at like a highly produced level
Putting
of nerdiness.
Jack
which I really
Forster
like.
And Ronnie Feig in the same room together might be the smartest thing Hilarious. Any of us have ever done. I mean, honestly,
anytime you get to read anything from Jack where he's really engaged, where he's about it.
Yeah.
Oh,
seeing, you know, and I'm going to blow up Jack's spot here a little bit. Sorry, Jack. Seeing Jack in a room with Ronnie Feig and some of the rarest sneakers ever produced and seeing Jack genuinely like almost drooling
sure.
over a pair of LeBrons is one of the coolest professional experiences I've ever had, because it's this moment where you realize whether we're talking about watches or diving or sneakers or cars or guitars or whatever, like anyone who is super deep in something has a kind of like shared personality
Absolutely.
Trait.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really easily, if you're already that deep on something, it's really not a big stretch to get that excited about something
like,
else.
Nerdiness,
as long as you meet somebody passionate.
Right. Nerdiness and enthusiasm, especially when you remove the money side of it. Like I don't genuinely care. Like if I write about a $300,000 car or a $900 Mito, like I try and operate where like it doesn't really matter what it costs, because that's up to the cohort that would buy it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about like, how does it make you feel? Like, what do you get for that? And that kind of thing. And like one of Jack's absolute skills is like the dude will find what's cool and he's already in tune. Like even if he doesn't like, you know what I mean? I don't know if he knows sneakers.
Like, no,
he knew something about sneakers,
like,
I'm sure, but like
a couple of weeks
just
was
attached
like
to
really
it.
Into it.
Yeah,
and
for
it's,
sure.
It's cool. It's awesome. And I think that's the thing that, you know, about the Hodinkee magazine to continue navel gazing for a second. Has been so exciting is that we get to meet those kinds of people and like nerd out just as nerds, not as watch nerds, kind of share that passion.
Just enthusiasm.
And, yeah, exactly.
And like it was enthusiasm that led you to the first thing you read about watches or the first watch you bought.
Totally.
And that doesn't die. And it's not that different than sneakers, and it's not that different than cars. It's not that different than pens or whatever anyone else has talked about on the podcast. I mean, like there's lots there. And the other thing that I appreciate about the team as a whole, And this is what I like. I like to see thoughtfulness in anything.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of thoughtfulness in the process, especially in the magazine. It's hugely laborious, the process. But the other thing I really like is you get I really like strong opinions but loosely held. So I want to be.
This is why we're friends.
Yeah. So I want to be like I will say like I hate that movie, and the next three sentences could change my mind.
Yeah,
change my mind.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you know, that meme of the dude with the mug. There's a statement on the table. Change my mind.
Right.
I'm down. Change my mind on anything. I'm game. Like, I think that when a really good idea comes across at the editorial meeting, there'll be a few people who have their minds changed.
Yeah.
Or three sentences later, the mind has changed. Or the person who pitched it, the
we
mind
also have
has
a lot
changed.
Of people who love coming in really hot.
Which,
for sure. Strong opinions, no shortage.
Yeah. But strong opinions, Lucy Hell. Mark Andreessen. Strong
That's
opinions,
great.
Lucy Hell is the way to operate. Because somebody has a different perspective than you, somebody has more information than you, somebody's flat out smarter than you. And hopefully I'm in a room that has all three of that all the time.
Yeah, I would agree.
And that's what you get. I think that's what we get with this team, is a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different strengths, disparate strengths, and like a keen focus at like, let's do something good, cool, fun.
So before we transition to the kind of closing segment of the show where I'll ask you guys some lightning round questions, let's look ahead for a second. What is the next big story that each of you is super excited to work on. It can be something that's
like a
already...
dream, like a dream thing or something that's in the works?
Either way. I think it can be something that's either greenlit that you're like super excited to dig into, or it can be something that like we'll have a conversation about after the mics go off about how to make it happen.
I have two things. I have a story coming up, and I don't know if I can share the details about it because I'm not sure when this episode will air, and I don't want to spoil the story idea. But it involves the Colorado Rockies and a certain very expensive watch.
It's going to be really good.
Oh, this story's going to be insane. Yeah.
This story's going to be absolutely bananas. I wasn't sure where you were going with that. I'm glad you went with this, and I'm glad you're keeping it a secret, too.
Yeah,
this story's going to be absolutely wild.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. But the other thing I've wanted to do, and I pitched it a year or so ago kind of loosely. I don't know if I talked to you about it, but I talked to a few people, maybe Ben and Frank, I think I talked to as well.
Okay.
Was the idea of sharing the passion of diving and dive watches with Hodinkee readers.
Yeah.
And TGN listeners. Mm-hmm. In the form of some sort of a...
like a field trip.
Hodinkee field trip, where people can sign up...
I love this idea.
...to come somewhere diving, where we will arrange... obviously, people will have to, you know, pay for, you know, certain aspects of it and whatever, but, you know, you have a sign up and you have a limited number of people that can come, and if you know how to dive, great. If not, you can sign up to learn. And perhaps a brand will get on board and provide some watches for people to wear, and Kashani can come along and do the underwater photography, and we can do evening Q&A sessions and discussions and things like that. It's kind of a
like a TGN Summit, like, you know, you can go back and listen to the TGN Summit episode, but like you meet up, you do some activities, like it'd be.
Let's ask people in the comments on Hodinkee or on Instagram or Twitter. Let us know if that's something you'd be interested
Essentially
in.
Essentially a guided trip.
Guided trip.
If you want to come on a Hodinkee field trip, let us know and we'll see what interest is. Because we've talked about this before. It would be such a fun idea.
So anyway, that's kind of my far-ranging sort of pie in the sky idea. So we'll see where that goes.
How about you, James?
I mean, as far as things I'm working on now, I honestly couldn't tell you. My brain's a little bit frazzled these days as far as like the current workload. You know, a lot of it's been H10, and then, you know, it's December, so that's always a really, you know, it's a month with a lot of free hours for everyone. Yeah, I think as far as like dream projects, I would love to just dig in a little bit more on like finding watches and getting them in their natural habitat. You know, Jason, you did a piece with the Explorer 2, the current gen Explorer 2, where you were climbing, and I think there's a methodology or a kind of format to be derived from that. I always thought it would be interesting to take, you know, to tell the story of Everest with an Explorer. The Explorer 1, which, you know, obviously has a strong connection, but do it while, you know, under the backdrop of actually doing the trek to the base camp.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? And so I think there's some big dreams in things like that. Other than that, you know, I'd love to see more... I'd love to see more the stuff that kind of falls adjacent to watches, like other interests that are watch adjacent. You know, we just ran a really amazing piece of sponsored content with IWC.
Mm.
And like if you're listening to this and you skip that, the photos are unbelievable. My home area, Pacific Northwest, Vancouver. So crack team went up there and just blew the shutters out. Jay and Walker for sure. And I think what they made was incredible visually. And I love that kind of work. Fascinated by it because, you know, it's something that people might only take in for a few minutes of their day. Maybe the first time they see it, they spend 15 minutes and look at all the pictures, but that's the product of somebody's months to put together.
Yeah.
That's just a high level of execution. It's beautiful.
Cool. Well, let's dive into the lightning round, which is how we close up our episode. So I'm going to ask you guys a question. You can each answer. It can be short answer. It can be a little bit longer, but we'll get through these and then close things up with a cultural recommendation.
Okay.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. You worried about that one?
I forgot.
It's all right. You got a few minutes.
Yeah, I got a couple.
Come up with something.
I'll dig.
So we'll start with Jason. What's a watch that has caught your eye recently?
You know, I think, you know, looking back at you know, kind of, we're closing out 2018, and I think, you know, the big standouts for me were the Tudor Black Bay 58 and the GMT this year. And I think I realized that was months ago, and much has been written and talked about those watches. But I feel like it was a real standout year for Tudor, and you know, they're kind of in my wheelhouse in terms of you know, watches that you know, made a real impact for a lot of people this year. Although I do think that, you know, as kind of throwback watches, you know, one could argue that it's kind of retreading familiar ground, but I think they did it in kind of a fresh way that almost reintroduces that genre to a new set of people.
So, I would agree.
Yeah.
James?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of I have to mirror that at a certain level, like huge love for Tudor and what they're managing to do in the sport watch segment at a reasonable price point, at a price point that appeals to enthusiasts. Obviously, they've sponsored the show before, so that's a like an easy sort of choice as far as like it's well within the milieu of the sort of thing that we love, Jason and I. And beyond that, I got my first Doxa this year, and I think that sub 300 is definitely my watch of the year personally.
Cool.
I mean, it's endless charm for $2,000, $2,200, something like that. I mean, find me something. If you like a sport watch, you like a dive watch, find me something more charming than that sub 300. I challenge you, because I don't think it exists on the market, certainly not for the money. I think that's the winner for me.
Sweet. We'll start with James on this one. What's the best place you've traveled in the last year?
That's a tough one. I'd have to look at my calendar. It all blends together at a certain point. It's funny because I'm tempted to just say New York, because I, you know, my experience, I grew up in near Toronto for, you know, people listening, roughly Toronto, and live in Vancouver currently. And yeah, I mean, I really like coming to New York. I like working here. I like obviously the team and everything. I mean, as far as a place to actually go, I would say Bavaria. So that part of Germany has been really great for me. I drove this is privilege. I drove a 715 horsepower Aston Martin DBS.
As one does.
I mean, if you can,
yeah.
Please do, through a sunny summer day in Bavaria. And I mean, that car makes sense in Germany. Germans like that car. You're not gonna you could get yourself into some trouble. You're not gonna get yourself into like the same sort of trouble you get into over here. And yeah, the it's right on the edge of the Alps. I had a similar drive through Kitzbühel, from Kitzbühel, Austria, down into Italy, and then back towards Munich. And I mean, if you can get to that part of the world when the weather's good, or if, I suppose if you're skiing, go in the winter. But if you can get to that part of the world and go for a drive, do a mountain pass. That's what I'd say. My answer is a mountain pass. You pick the one. Don't do it in Switzerland. If you get to the ones in Switzerland, you'll have speeding tickets or camera tickets by the time you get to the mountain pass, and they'll be very expensive. And then you'll get there and the mountain pass will be full of cyclists. So you're not going to be able to drive that fast anyways. But I did Grossglockner in Austria. I've done, I don't remember the name of the one in Bavaria. But there's, you know, there's lots of great driving roads there. And I honestly think you could have fun in a rental car. I don't think it has to be an Aston Martin. I don't think it has to be a new Continental. I don't think it has to be a Ferrari or anything like that. I think that it's gorgeous, and their driving roads meant to be driven. They're beautifully maintained. The scenery's incredible. Bring a camera, pack a lunch. But if you end up in any of those places, if you're near any of these cities, Munich, Kitzbühel, you know, if you're around, take a day and see a mountain pass.
Great. How about you, Jason?
It was a good year for me, travel wise. But I think a real standout for me was it was actually a tiny, uninhabited rock that juts out of the Eastern Pacific Ocean called Roca Partida.
Okay,
it's incredible.
It's in Spanish it means split rock, and it looks like a giant manta ray coming up out of the ocean.
Oh,
it's
the, sweet.
Sort of these two lobes of rock that come up out of the sea, and there's not much else. There's nothing around them. It took an overnight boat ride from another remote archipelago of islands in the Pacific to get to it. And we dove on it for 2 days, living on a boat. And it's just primeval. I mean, it's like Jurassic Park. The diving there was very tough, very athletic diving. It's high currents and it's deep and it's fairly cold and,
That's part of the Riviera Gallegos, correct?
Yeah,
yeah. And but it's like as far west.
Yeah. And it's probably one of the last places on the planet that you can see huge schools of tuna, you know, hunting, just, you know, manta rays swooping around, whale sharks, all sorts of, you know, just incredible pelagic species. I think the sense of a certain element of danger was there, and it sort of heightened the, you know, it gets you sort of, your synapses are firing, your sort of your antennae are up because you feel like at any moment if I get blown off in the current, no one's going to find me. And so you're very conscious of being in the moment and taking care. But in the meantime, you know, every place you look around you underwater, there's just this incredible life. And it was a real privilege to dive there. It was a 9-day live aboard trip with some pretty amazing divers, courtesy of Blanc Pond back in May. So that was my highlight for 2018.
Very nice. All right, we'll keep this going back and forth. So we'll start with you on this one, Jason. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received, and who gave that advice to you?
Ah, okay. I had a really good boss. One of my first jobs, I was a technical writer for a packaging machinery company. So I used to write manuals for big machines. And I was going through a particularly tough time in my life at that point. And I remember my boss, who actually was not based in Minneapolis, but used to fly in regularly, took me out for dinner one night. And I was kind of pouring my heart out and talking about some things that were going on in my life at the time. And at the end of the evening, I think I was, you know, apologetic. I was saying, you know, sorry, I'm, you know, bearing my soul and telling you all this stuff. And she said, you know what, Jason, it's all one life. There's no separation between work and home and fun and pleasure. And I think it meant something at that time for what I was going through, but it also was good advice for where we are now. I mean, if what you're doing for work is the same as, brings you a great amount of pleasure and it's, enriches your life, it should, you know, and, that lack of separation as you kind of move through your day and through your year, has always stuck with me, and I've tried to kind of make that my personal credo.
That's so great.
Yeah.
I love that. James, how about you?
Yeah, I could start by saying I don't remember who gave me this advice.
Okay.
But I've lived by it for a long time, and I think that I've seen it's one of these few things that has allowed me to, like, escape some of the scourge of entitlement, especially among millennials, you're owed nothing. And I think about it a lot. I think that the idea that I think there's a difference between wanting and believing that you're owed something.
Sure.
And it's one thing to want something. It's another thing to believe that you should just have it by nature. And yet you see this behavior all the time.
Yeah.
And I find it upsetting. I find it problematic to correct for. It's very difficult to convince somebody they're not owed something that they believe they're owed.
Sure.
Right? But even if you go to a scenario where technically you are owed something, like, say, customer service at a big box retailer or something like that, the way that people behave is just it's just kind of insane.
Yeah.
In terms of the fact that, like, you just aren't owed anything in this life. So what you get, you either ask for, and I believe very strongly in asking for what you want. And I think the rest of the time you need to process what it is that would, like, maybe make you happy, and then make some sort of a plan, steps to get that stage. Because I'm in my early 30s now, and like you have to, I've learned many times that, like, you're not owed the job that you want. You're not owed the car you want. You're not owed the amount of money that you want. You're not owed anything. You have to get up in the morning, decide what you want from that day, and try and make it happen. And so if you're listening, and we get asked, and I'm sure Steven, you get asked, like, how do I get your job? Or somebody, I explain in three sentences what my job is, and they go, oh, nice life.
Yeah,
and you're like, yeah, it's a great life. And you know what? And my general second sentence, if it's somebody that I don't mind talking to, is like, eventually the music's going to stop, and I just hope there's a chair.
Yeah.
Because eventually somebody will figure out they shouldn't give me 800 horsepower cars in Germany. You know what I mean? Or like, you have to, every single time is another interview. Every piece of work is another interview. And I believe that even if you're in a normal work day,
yeah,
every single day is another chance to, like, establish the fact that you're worth something, that you're doing good work, that you're putting something out in the world. And but I think if you operate from a position where, like, however it goes, you basically got there based on your actions is a better way of operating than assuming there's some fate or some destiny involved in it. I can't find any truth in the latter.
Nice. Well, before we do the cultural recommendation, one last question, and that's, do either of you have a guilty pleasure?
Who's defining guilty? I mean, what one person's guilty.
You're defining guilty.
I'll defer to James on this. I'll have to think on that.
I mean, I'm like, people who know me know I'm a man of many proclivities.
Oh boy.
I would say like it. Like
we have another. We're gonna have another 1 hour show after this where James talks about those many proclivities.
Yeah. The I mean the easy one is probably like I love gummies.
Oh yeah.
Like Haribo. I love like if you have a Whole Foods. I've not been able to find them in Whole Foods in the States, but the Whole Foods near my place in Vancouver has these juice berries. They're like dark red kind of gummies, and there's a sour variety that's not actually sour. It's just sugared, and there's a naan, which is just like shiny, and you buy both and then mix them together.
Okay.
And that's just about as good as, I don't know, you can't call it food, but whatever it is.
Hodinkee Radio, the gummies episode coming soon.
You can't really call that. And, you know, I like that.
We have quite a few Haribo devotees.
Absolutely, it's a real Twin Snakes vibe happening at the Hodinkee office, which I'm about, especially when, shout out to St. Cara, she put them in the freezer.
She did, it's a pro move.
It's a game changer. She's operating on a different level, for sure.
Wow.
She knows gummies, she knows her way around some gummies.
Doesn't it break your teeth?
A little bit,
You gotta treat it, you can't treat it like a gummy at that point. You gotta give it a minute.
Suck on a
thing. You gotta give it a minute.
It's just new, it's kind of a different game, but the... you know, that I'm certainly not, you know, I appreciate some whiskey here there, which isn't something that I would necessarily.
Yeah. I don't think you have to feel guilty.
I don't know that's
that.
A necessarily guilty pleasure.
Life's, that we might actually have.
Life cereal.
Cereal is my cereal in general.
Oh, just life cereal. Fruit Loops. I'm not sure that's a guilty pleasure. If there's a guilty pleasure in the context of Hodinkee, maybe it's quartz watches.
All right. That's fair. You know? You're left.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Cool. So let's wrap things up. Let's do a cultural recommendation. James, what are you watching, reading, listening to, telling other people about these days?
I mean, like this is one where it came up in a conversation the other day, and so I'm essentially recommending what either was or should have been a blockbuster film. So this may not be a big swing for everyone, but the more people I talk to about this movie, the more they're like, it wasn't good.
Okay.
And here I am. Here's my bold statement. Prove me wrong. Blade Runner, 2049.
The movie's great.
I adored
it. People didn't like it.
And yet most people tell me it wasn't great. I've seen
You're talking to the wrong people.
I mean, this is probably the case. But, you know, like I bet you I've seen it well over 10 times at this point.
Wow.
And I think it's some of the finest cinematography on record, period. Movie. Any movie.
It's pretty amazing.
The use of color is incredible. I think the acting is incredible. I think the story works amazing. It's my favorite working director, my favorite cinematographer in the world. And, you know, same dude that did Skyfall, which is also a gorgeous film that wasn't necessarily a perfect movie otherwise, but looked like, I mean, just unbelievable. It's unlike you get lost, but you can get lost in just simple seconds. But I'll find that, like, not only is it on planes because it's Blade Runner, I love the old Blade Runner and I adore the new one. And if you saw it and you liked it, then I guess I'm not talking to you. You saw it, it's good. But if you saw it and you're like, I don't get this, like, Give it another spin.
And then at James on Instagram.
On Twitter.
Twitter, yeah.
I'm not on Twitter.
Oh, perfect. Add him in the comments on some random story.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I would say it's something where like the more people that I chat to about this movie, when movies come up, it's like, it seems divisive.
Okay.
And I think it's nothing short of a work of art. It's probably the last movie of its entire genre that will use miniatures. So instead of just using computers, they spent $25+ million like making miniatures like they did for the original Blade Runner to lend a certain amount of authenticity. Gosling, I'm never not going to go to bat for Gosling, fellow Canadian, you know, Ontario boy, like bring it on. Like it's a great.
Where's a sick watch?
Great movie. Yeah, fantastic watch for sure. Cool. So that's my swing is for all of you out there who either don't like sci-fi or like flat out didn't like Blade Runner, watch it again.
All right. How about you, Jason?
Well, I was going to do a movie, but I think...
You can still do a movie.
Well, I think I'm going to switch to a book because winter's coming and this is...
book season.
It's book season, but it's also the time when I dust off my collection of polar literature.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love a good book about suffering in the Arctic or Antarctic, you know, especially living in Minneapolis.
As we all do.
Yes. Yeah. And I just got a new one, and I've just cracked it, so I haven't even finished it. But I love the author. The author's name is David Gran. He wrote The Lost City of Z, which they made into a movie a couple of years ago. I think he won National Book Award or
Pulitzer. It's an incredible book.
Great book. But I'm going to recommend his latest, which is called The White Darkness. And it's...
I saw you put this on Instagram.
Yeah, what a title.
Yeah.
I'm in.
It's actually a short little compact book. Usually when I travel nowadays, books are just, they don't quite fit in the bag. But this is just a slim little volume. It's got some great photos in it. And it's about a recent expedition, fairly tragic, in which a descendant of one of Ernest Shackleton's crew from the early 1900s became obsessed with Shackleton as sort of a mentor, you know, read everything he could about him, and to the point where he wanted to retrace his steps and actually cross the Antarctic continent. And he was a British Army veteran, very skilled, and he'd done a couple of polar expeditions in the past, but he wanted to do a solo crossing of the Antarctic continent, just 2012, I think it was.
Wow.
Actually, no, probably more recent than that. So this book is a very poignant, sympathetic sort of look at this guy's life and sort of this obsession he had with Shackleton and this sort of noble, sort of old school explorer, sort of gentleman explorer sort of sense that he had. And I read, there was sort of a version of the book or sort of an excerpt that was published in a magazine, I think it was The New Yorker or Vanity Fair or something, that that just made me really want to read the book. And a friend of mine just gave me a signed first edition of it, so I'm really excited about it. So yeah, check it out.
Awesome.
What you got?
I'm going to recommend the total opposite of that for winter, which is like the cushiest possible thing that I love in winter. I just made a reservation at this restaurant, which is why I was thinking about it. We go every year for my wife's birthday. But if you have not eaten the chicken at the Nomad Hotel, you are doing life super wrong.
Okay.
This is probably the only time I order chicken at a restaurant. Like I'm one of those people who's like, I love a good roast chicken, but like, why would I order chicken at a restaurant? Right. Usually for two people, it's a pain in the ass. It's a whole thing. The roast chicken at the Nomad is unreal. There's like a truffle brioche breadcrumbs foie gras situation that they put under the skin and then they roast it. And it's like, it's a whole thing, but it's just like, it's unbelievable. I have it once or twice a year and it's unbelievable every single time. I made a reservation. It's still almost a month away from when we're recording this. And I'm like actively excited about this meal, like hourly as we head get closer to it. So I would say if you haven't had this, it's one of my favorite meals in the world. I think this restaurant's one of the best restaurants in New York City. If you want like a really, you know, elevated, nice experience, they take great care of you. The service is awesome. I would recommend go to the Nomad on like a cold night with somebody you like, get the chicken for two, hunker down. Brooklyn Brewery does a special beer paired with the chicken that is only served at the Nomad. Get the beer. It's great. It's like if you want a nice meal out in the city this winter, to me, that doesn't get any better than that.
Super.
That's awesome. Well, they don't take walk-ins, I'm guessing, there.
I think they do, actually. Yeah. I think they take
walk-ins. Can I get it for takeout?
You actually might be able to.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. Right.
It's not a press at the table scenario, French style?
It's not. It's not okay. Press at the table situation.
Okay.
They do bring the whole bird out to you and then take it back to the kitchen and carve it. But you do see people like walking around the dining room with like whole chickens.
Do you ever start over?
Maybe I should.
Like, what's the act of bringing, you already cooked the bird.
I wonder if anybody's ever done like, that. Just been like, nah, I don't like this one.
Like, it's not like picking a lobster at the restaurant.
Right.
Like, I don't need to know the bird's name. Yeah. I don't need, like, I know what a chicken looks like.
I would prefer not to know the bird's name.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's up to you.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, thank you guys for joining us. This was super, super fun. We obviously, like, talk all the time, but to get a chance to sit down, no distractions, no interruptions, and talk shop for a little while is really nice, especially as we head into the wonderful madness that's going to be the H10 weekend. This may be the last time the three of us have a conversation with one another this weekend.
Yeah, but enjoy the quiet of the studio here.
Yeah.
Three of us enter, one of us will make it out, maybe.
Two of us are casualties.
My
of
money
the,
is on
excitement. Yeah. Oh, Jason, for sure. You and I are toast.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, guys. And
thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you again to Jason and James for joining us. This episode was recorded at Miratone Studios in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.